All right, so we're going to pick up on part two of the Animessiah. We'll pick up the Sabbath and talking about the Animessiah. And for a review, I think most everybody was here, but just to get our heads thinking, we discussed that the final four seals of Revelation 6 describe a new world order that emerges and the coming of a future world war. It will be a global new world order, completely reconfiguring the face of the earth, especially in the Middle East. And it's described in the book of Revelation in pretty vivid detail. We looked at Revelation 6, verses 1 and 2, about the first seal, and how this represents the anti-Messiah and not the Messiah. And I would say, you know, the COVID situation has, in one sense, been a profound gift to shake us up, to be in a position to consider the realities of what may be coming, prophetically and in the future. One little thing can change and set off a chain reaction of events and shut the earth and man's world down. We all have some different opinions about COVID, who's responsible, is this blown out of proportion, any of those things. But regardless of what you think about COVID, the thing that we do know, you can't disagree about, is kind of brought the world to a halt. But I want to say what I'm going to say next emphatically and very clearly, but with a level of gentleness. This COVID thing is nothing but a speed bump compared with what we're going to see. In terms of the catastrophic nature of the storm that is ahead of us, we're going to look back at this and say, do you remember when we thought this was bad? This is nothing. Nothing compared to what's coming. It's kind of interesting that children really haven't been affected much by COVID. That's not going to be the case in the future pandemics. It's not going to be the case in the future calamities. Children will be affected in a very heavy way. Now, you may think I'm overblowing it. We talked about, in a snap of a finger, the fourth seal is going to take 25% of the earth's population. Again, that's why I think COVID's really nothing. It's like a pebble in your shoe compared to what's probably coming. But remember that it's the Messiah who is the one that's releasing these things. So we say that also about the anti-Messiah. The rider on the right, white horse, represented the anti-Messiah. We looked at Revelation 6, 1 and 2. We also looked at Daniel 9, Daniel 11, and others. And we talked a little bit about the two options about whether it's torn at the beginning of the first 7 weeks of the last 7 weeks, or the 70th week, or is it after the abomination of desolation? So we'll know quickly once these things begin to unfold. Now, there's a lot of scriptures that speak of the anti-Messiah and his activities. These are just a few. But I wanted to say that the issue of the anti-Messiah is not a fringe issue in scripture. It's become kind of a fringe issue in pop Christianity because of all the fringe pastors and prophets over the years who have weaved and detailed wild teachings over the anti-Messiah and the mark of the beast. They've made it weird and even brought shame and created a stigma on the issue. So now we're going to look at several books in the Old and New Testament where the anti-Messiah is mentioned and discussed, and the issue of the anti-Messiah amongst the earliest believers is not the issue amongst today's believers. Back then, it was a normal reality that everyone was aware of. They understood him to be a central player in Yah's unfolding purposes on the earth in the generation before Messiah's return. And those purposes inform what's taking place in the generations before Messiah's return. meaning Paul could write to a nearly brand new congregation in Asia Minor in the first century and talk about the theology of the anti-Messiah and actually say, this has a bearing on things in your life today. And I'm going to show that to you. That's what Paul does in one of the letters. He takes the issue of the anti-Messiah and actually speaks into the here and the now, the life of the body of believers. In the context of the life of the believers, it was that were basically unreached people up to that point before Paul went and engaged them. So amongst the apostles reaching early new believers, this issue of the anti-Messiah was discussed and used with no qualms. It was very normal. In today's time, that would never be done amongst church planting or in the context of making new disciples or new believers. It is not a normal thing nowadays. It's even shied away from. So what is it that we have lost? What has changed? So I want to take some time to kind of decookify, if I will, the subject of the anti-Messiah. We want to study the anti-Messiah primarily so that we can understand Yah's purposes on earth in our generation and the generation of the Messiah's return, so that we could be holy, so that we could be engaged, so that we could be clear, so that we could be of redemptive use in our generation and in the generation of Messiah's return, if that's not one and the same. The context for the emergence of the little horn globally right now is very conducive for that emergence. For instance, in the first time in 2,000 years, there's now preliminary prerequisite conditions that must be met in order for his emergence to even be possible. So if Paul was doing this in the first century and telling believers that, hey, this is relevant, then I think it should be also conclude that it's a relevant thing for us. So with that, we're going to start in 2 Thessalonians. And this is a pastoral epistle. And when you see it in a pastoral perspective, it puts it in the right context. Meaning, I don't think that we need to study the anti-Messiah so that we can have a clear understanding of end-time events alone. I think we need to find that it is clear in our hearts and in our minds that it actually affects every other area of our lives. But the context of that clarity is very important. And I think the pastoral framework is a real healthy framework to wrestle and grapple with this in. So in 2 Thessalonians, this is a congregation that is going through persecution. As you read in chapter 1, we're not going to, but you can go back. They're going through immense suffering. And Paul's writing to them and saying, hey guys, in chapter 1, he says, I know you're being afflicted. And here's the deal. Here's how you can have comfort in the midst of your affliction. He then talks about the coming of the Messiah. And then he gets to chapter 2, and he says this. And I appreciate that Zach went through 2 Thessalonians the other day in his study. And we'll read here in verse 1. It says, now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Master, Yeshua the Messiah, and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind, or be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letters, as from us, as that day of the Messiah is at hand. Let no man deceive you, again, the deception thing, by any means. For that day shall not come except there be falling away first, and that the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. Now, notice something really important here in verses 1 and 2. And he's tying together the coming of the Messiah, the second coming, with the gathering of the saints, which, of course, is what we talked about this morning. He's tying those two things together with the day of the Lord, or the day of Yahweh. In other words, Paul's defining the day of Yahweh as the day Messiah comes the second time, and the day he comes to gather his people. And then in verse 3, he says that the day of Yahweh will not come until or unless the rebellion or the great falling away comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. So remember, Paul's teaching to a group of fairly new believers. Let's go on in verse 4. We notice here in verse 4, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called Elohim, or that is worshipped, so that he as Elohim sitteth in the temple of Elohim, showing himself that he is Elohim. Remember you not that when I was yet with you, I told you of these things. And now you know what holdeth that he might be revealed in this time. For the mystery of the iniquity doth already work, only who now will let until it be taken out of the way. So I'll pause again for a moment for us to think about Paul's writing to a fairly brand new congregation, fledgling young, and says, guys, I want to encourage you. And then he quotes from Daniel 11. The day of Yahweh, the second coming of Yeshua, the Messiah, will not come. The gathering of his people will not happen until when? There's a falling away first from the body, and the anti-Messiah is revealed. So, who are we talking about? There's a lot of people have debated, well, the body of Messiah, the temple is spiritual, and we're talking about a spiritual thing, or is that a physical thing? You know, and this person is, you know, has the spirit of Satan working in him. You know, there's a lot of debate over this. In my mind, it's pretty simple. Can a human being enter the spiritual temple of Yah? He can have an effect on us, but can he really enter it? He can only allow it to happen if Yah allows it to happen. But when he says he enters and sits in the temple, this would have some kind of connotation that he sits with authority, like, for instance, taking the place of the high priest, sitting in judgment. Only one person can sit in authority over the spiritual body of Messiah. So it would seem to me that it is somehow talking about a physical temple. Paul's talking to this congregation in Thessalonica and encouraged them by quoting Daniel 11 and letting them know that things must happen before the day of Yahweh and Messiah's return and the gathering of the people. And that's the main point I wanted to get across. Again, these are all prerequisites, looking at the timing. Let's go on then. We see where he says in verse 5, where Paul's kind of normalizing what he writes here. And in verse 5, he says, I already told you all about this when I was with you. So he's just reminding them and encouraging them. And I think this is significant. Because if you look in the book of Acts, it says that Paul was in Thessalonica for 3 Sabbaths. 3 weeks. So Paul goes into an unreached people, probably mostly new believers. There may have been some Jews who were in Jerusalem on that Pentecost in Acts 2. But the majority were likely newer believers. And Paul goes in and he proclaims the gospel. He makes disciples. He sets elders. And then he leaves. After just 3 weeks, then Paul writes them because he hears that they are confused and there's disagreement over the issue of the day of Yahuwah, the day of the Lord. St. Pope said the day of Yahweh has already come. And Paul says, no, let me define the day of Yahweh. Let me define the day of the Lord and when it will happen. There's no way that you've missed it. I promise. Yeshua returns. That hasn't happened. He comes to gather his people. That hasn't happened. So whoever told you that, don't buy it. Then he says, guys, that day can't come anyways because these other events that must happen. The falling away, the man of sin, the anti-Messiah being revealed. And then he says, don't you remember I told you all this? So Paul saw it appropriate and fitting that in the 3 weeks that he was there in Thessalonica with these fairly new believers to teach them about what the book of Daniel says about the final anti-Messiah. That's unusual, don't you think? With the 3 weeks Paul was with them in the beginning stages of them discovering who Yeshua is, the gospel, all that he was teaching them, Paul was deep into the book of Daniel and the end time events. To me, that's incredible. That's certainly not something that we would see in modern missionary circles. I'm not sure we would see that in our backgrounds that would happen. Because they would think, well, they're new believers, that's a little bit too much for them. Paul had 3 weeks with them, and he went into great detail and in great depth. So I think that's something important for us to keep in mind. Then we go to verse 6. It says, now you know what holdeth that he might be revealed in his time. Something is restraining this from happening until its time. But the spirit of Antipasite was already at work in that day. So there's a lot of teachings out there about who is restraining. Who is the restrainer? Well, obviously, since the Father and the Son are rolling these things out and are in control, you might think it's them. But consider that Satan, under God's timeline, is the restrainer. He doesn't want this to happen. Because once this happens, once he, as Satan, is cast out of heaven, then he knows he only has a certain amount of time left. But it'll happen in Yah's timeline. Then we get to verse 8. It says, then shall the wicked be revealed, whom the master shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. Hold on, Paul. You mean the guy, the Savior that we worship, who died on the stake, you mean he's going to kill somebody? What about that loving Messiah that we hear about in the churches? You mean he's going to physically, personally kill someone? Well, we talked about that this morning a little bit. Yeah, just the mere appearance of his coming and the breath of his mouth. Right? And he will annihilate him. It's no contest. I think when we read that, especially when you consider where it talks about the nations up to this point are saying, who can make war with him? And Yeshua goes, and he's done. Verse 9, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. Again, who's causing it? They're performing it, but who's causing it and for what reason? I'll remind you again what we talked about in the first day back in the Torah about how that it's Yah who sets the false prophets up to test his people. And then in verse 10, he says, with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of truth that they might be saved. Paul's telling them that, as we read on here in verse 11 and 12, and it says, and for this cause, Yah shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believed not the truth and had pleasure in unrighteousness. So Paul's telling them, when this is happening, and even if you're not of that generation, you're still going to be battling the spirit of the anti-Messiah and the workings of Satan, because it's already at work in our midst. So love the truth, cling to the truth about who Yeshua is, what he and the Father has done for us, the looking forward to his kingdom being established, not just in our hearts and amongst the body, but governing the whole earth. This is how we fight against, how we stand against the onslaught of the evil one. Matthew 24, again, and Yeshua answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I'm the Messiah, and shall deceive many. Again, a repeat from the other day. But he continues to warn us, don't be deceived, because many are going to be deceived. Again, we talked about Deuteronomy 13, Law of Moses, and this Yah who is sending this up. I now want to go to Ezekiel 28. And Ezekiel 28 is one of those scriptures there's a little controversy over, I guess. But it seems as though it's clear. It's physically speaking of people, but it's also spiritually speaking, I believe. As we begin Ezekiel 28, it's speaking of the prince of Tyre. And there likely was a prince of Tyre that fulfilled as a type maybe some of these things. But it's also a prophecy of the anti-Messiah. So in verse 1 it says, the word of Yahweh come again unto me, saying, son of man, say unto the prince of Tyre, thus saith Yahweh Elohim, because thine heart is lifted up. And now it said, I am God. I sit in the seat of Elohim in the midst of the seas. When it's talking about the midst of the seas, what's that talking about? Well, in Israel, it's talking between the Mediterranean and the Sea of Galilee or the Dead Sea. It sits between the midst of the seas. Yet thou art a man and not Elohim. Thou hast thought and set in thy heart of God. Behold, thou art wiser than Daniel. There is no secret that can be hide from you. With thy wisdom and with thine understanding thou hast gotten thee riches, and hast gotten gold and silver unto thy treasures. And by thy great wisdom and by thy traffic hast thou increased thy riches, and thy heart is lifted up because of thy riches. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh Elohim, because thou hast set thine heart as the heart of God, behold, there I will bring strangers upon thee, the terrible of the nations, and they shall draw their swords against the beauty of thy wisdom, and they shall defile thy brightness. And he shall bring thee down into the pit, and shall die the deaths of them that are slain in the midst of the sea. Wilt thou yet say before him that slayeth thee, I am a god? But thou shalt be a man and no god in the hand of him that slayeth thee. And thou shalt die in the deaths of the uncircumcised by the hand of the stranger. For I have spoken it, says Yahuwah Elohim. So I think we can see here a lot of parallels from what we've read already about the Antimessiah. It talks about he wants to set up himself as God. He wants to set himself up to be like that. It's very similar to what Satan did. But he'll be brought down to the pit. Now, if we go on in Ezekiel 28, it was speaking of the Prince of Tyre, but now it's starting to talk about the King of Tyre. And I believe, and you may not, that it's speaking of Satan. Verse 11, it says, Moreover, the word of Yahweh come unto me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the King of Tyre, and say unto him, Thus saith Yahweh Elohim, Thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of Elohim. Every precious stone was thy covering, the sardis, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, the carbuncle, and gold. The workmanship of thy tablets and of thy pipes were prepared in the day that thou wast created. Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth. And I've set thee so, that was upon the holy mountain of Elohim, that thou walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. So this was speaking of Satan, Lucifer, before he fell. Then it goes on in verse 15. Thou was perfect in thy ways from the day that thou was created until iniquity was found in you. And by the multitude of thy merchandise, they have filled the midst of thee with violence. And thou hast sinned. Therefore I will cast as profane out from the mountain of Elohim, and I will destroy thee, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. Thou hast corrupt thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness. I will cast thee to the ground. I will lay thee before kings that they may behold thee. Thou hast defiled the sanctuaries by the multitude of thy iniquities, by the iniquity of thy traffic. Therefore I will bring you forth a fire from the midst of thee, and I shall devour thee. And I will bring thee to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all of them that behold thee. And they shall know thee among the people, shall be astonished. Thou shalt be a terror, and shall never be any more. We see some parallels here between what this is saying about Satan and what the Antimessiah will be doing. He lifts himself up, believes that he is God, sets himself in the temple, but he's going to be brought down. Isaiah 14 is another scripture that we go to in this regard. As these verses begin, it's obvious it's talking again about Satan, Lucifer. But notice as the verses continue, it changes, and it's talking about the Assyrian. I spoke about that the other day, the Assyrian, the Antimessiah. So beginning of verse 12, How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thy heart, I will ascend unto heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of Elohim. I will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north, and I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet thou wilt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit. They that see thee shall narrowly look upon thee and consider thee, saying, Is this the man that made earth tremble, that shake kingdoms? Notice it's kind of shifting here. That made the world as a wilderness and destroyed all the cities thereof, that opened not the house of his prisoners. All the kings of the nations, even all, lie in glory, every one in his own house. And verse 19, but thou cast out thy grave like an abominable branch, and as the raiment of those that are slain, thrust through with a sword that go down to the stones of the pit, as a carcass trodden underfoot. Thou shalt not be joined with them in burial, because thou destroyed thy land and slain the people. The seed of evildoers shall never be renowned. Prepare the slaughter for his children for the iniquity of their fathers, that they do not rise nor possess the land, nor fill the face of the earth with cities. For I will rise up against them, says Yahuwah of hosts, and cut them off. Babylon, the name and remnant and son and nephew, said Yahuwah, I will make it a possession for the bitter and the pools of water. And I will sweep in with the besom of destruction, says Yahuwah of hosts. Yahuwah of hosts hath sworn, saying, surely I have thought, so it shall come to pass. As I have purposed, so shall it stand. And then in verse 25, that I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon the mountains tread him underfoot. Then shall his yoke depart from them, and his burden depart off their shoulders. This is the purpose that is purposed upon the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out all the nations. For Yahuwah of hosts has purposed, and who shall disannul it? And his hand is stretched out, and who shall turn it back? So again, we read here about the Assyrian, about the anti-Messiah, and you know, he's going to be destroyed at Yah's coming, as we read a little bit about this morning. So I want to propose something here to you, something that I've been reflecting on and pondering over. Is the anti-Messiah going to be the incarnation of Satan himself in the same way that Yeshua was the incarnation of God? The incarnate, the Word made flesh. You know, in the beginning, the Word was the Word, and the Word was with Elohim, and the Word was Elohim, and the Word became flesh. In the same way, Satan is going to be incarnate and is going to be made flesh. Is this the mystery of iniquity? And I'm just asking this, and I'm just proposing it because it's something I've been thinking. You know, the mystery of godliness is talked about in 1 Timothy 3:16. And Paul writes that the mystery of godliness is that God was manifested in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the nations, believed on in the world, received up to glory. That's the mystery of godliness. And I wanted to focus on that first part. God was manifested in the flesh. It's a mystery. So if the mystery of godliness is God manifested in the flesh, then is the mystery of iniquity Satan being manifested in the flesh? Okay, just something I've been thinking about. I'm not saying it's the gospel. But if I'm right, this mystery of iniquity manifested in the flesh is in accordance with, in line with, all of Satan's behavior and influence down through history. It's consistent because he's behind it. Now, what happens at the end with the final anti-Messiah is really a culmination or a climax of historical events continuing down through history. Yahweh is going to use, he's going to allow it. He's going to raise him up to test the body of believers and to test the nations. He's going to use this final tyrant as a way to separate the sheep from the goats, from in the nations and from his body. It's a great testing rod. It's a great divider. The final anti-Messiah is all about testing the hearts of humanity before the coming of the day of the Lord, the day of Yahuwah. In the same way that Pharaoh was a picture or a type of the anti-Messiah, Yah raised Pharaoh up and used him for his purpose and for his glory. The same could be said about Nebuchadnezzar. Same could be said about Antiochus Epiphanes. Same could be said about Haman. The same could be said about a number of dictators down through history, that Yah was using them for his purpose. He's not surprised by them. He's using them to test and to divide. I want you to exhort you to go back and look at Ezekiel 38 and 39 when you have time and study it closely. They're amongst some of the most important chapters in Scripture that describe the activity and the military conquest of the final beast under the government of the Antimessiah. It's geopolitical context. I say that to say this, that in the coming days, we're going to be looking at what happens in the Middle East when the beast and this anti-Messiah emerges onto the world scene. So I'd like to end with a little contemporary news and a story. The contemporary news, it's not breaking in the last day or anything, but it's something that's happened over the last few years that has received really little or no notice. The nation of Turkey, under Erdogan, under his regime, has thrown in the country of Libya. Now, Libya has had a very rough decade or so since the Arab Spring. And from the time of this Arab Spring, we have been watching this whole reconfiguring of the Middle East. We have watched the lions of the Middle East topple. We saw Gaddafi fall. We saw Saddam Hussein fall. We watched all these strong men in the Middle East topple, and we have seen the Middle East trying to find its footing. But now we are in a very interesting situation. When we look at the passage in Daniel 11 and in passages like Ezekiel 38 and 39, and when we look at passages relating to the Great Tribulation and the conquest of the final beast, what we see is that these nations, particularly what is coming out of modern-day Turkey and Syria, throw in with specific countries in North Africa. And there's a brutal, earth-shattering clash with the nations of Egypt, with the nations of Israel, with the Arabian Peninsula, and there's a great divide. In the middle of all this, the Mediterranean powers that be at the time will be sucked into this war that will be coming, and it'll be a brutal conflict. Now, I do not want to be involved in newspaper clipping eschatology, but I thought it's very interesting and very significant that we have an aligning of certain Islamic countries in North Africa with Turkey, and that Syria is right in the middle of this. Because Antiochus Epiphanes, who is the type that we read about in the book of Daniel and in the book of Maccabees, of the emergence of the final beast, he's a type of that. The final little horn, this end time anti-Messiah. Antiochus emerges on the world scene in the wake of carnage in Syria and in and around what is modern-day Syria. And he's a type. And I believe what we could be witnessing right now in the Middle East and in North Africa is the beginning days of context setting for what will lead to the emergence and the rise of the little horn. So now here is what is sobering about this, guys. He may be alive right now on earth. And it may be a matter of months or years before we see him starting. functioning in the beginning stages of his role. I'm going to end with a story. I want you to imagine that it's 1929. And you're a young man, and you're attending a college or, you know, a seminary or working in a factory, or you have a family business and you live in Berlin. And you're looking out for the next few years of your life and the next few decades, planning. And you have a sweet girl and you're planning to get married and having children, and you're planning what your future is going to look like. And all of a sudden, a little Austrian corporal named Adolf Hitler runs for the chancellor. He's not really taken seriously. No one really pays much attention. He only gets maybe 10% of the vote. No one really takes him seriously. Winston Churchill took him seriously at that point, but others did not. Now the next election comes, and it would move, and he sweeps into office, and it would move Germany from a democracy to a dictatorship in less than 3 months. And the final solution was put into motion. After that, two theaters of war exploded. 50 million people died on the battlefields all over the world. Over 6 million Jews and others were systematically annihilated. And the church was totally divided and tested. Europe lay in ruins and rubble. The Western powers threw in to try to save Europe as this beast empire is ravaging the Christian Europe. And so why do I tell you this story? To show you about how it's not weird to talk about the anti-Messiah being raised up. Adolf Hitler was a dress rehearsal for what is to come. You know, we talk about the anti-Messiah and the end times, and people say, that's so crazy, so fantastical, so weird. Guys, it just happened less than 100 years ago. There are people alive on the earth today who still have tattoos on their arms. That's not weird. It's already happened. If we look at that in Yah's time, he says 1,000 years is as a day. So 100 years is like a tenth of a day, like 2.4 hours ago. The other reason I tell this story is to help us put it into a personal context. Imagine if it was 1929 and you had foresight of what would follow over the next, say, 15 years. These are the questions I will leave you with. If you knew this was coming, if it was coming, it is coming, would you live your life differently? Would you spend your time differently? Would you spend your money differently? Would you spend your relational energy differently? What would you quit? And what would you start doing? Brethren, this issue of the end of the age, this issue of the final little horn, the final anti-Messiah, has implications that are far-reaching for us and is going to go very deep and are going to touch all of us in a very intimate way. This time, though, it's going to be much more catastrophic. This stuff needs to be normalized. We need to teach on it. We need to study it. We need to understand it. We need to take it out of the closet. The days are urgent. We need to be sober-minded. We need to know what the word says so that we can understand what Yah is asking from us in these savage days ahead. And again, it's the eternal, the Father through his Son, will be orchestrating all of this. And because it's his plan and his purpose, it's how he will be testing all mankind, but especially his people. Will you be ready? Comments or questions?
What's with the watermelon?
Give him the mic back. He can explain it better than anybody. Any serious questions or comments? All right. Guess I'm all done.
I'm interested in some newspaper clippings.
Eschatology, yeah.
Is there something going on in Turkey right now that's caught your interest?
Well, it's been going on for a little while. You know, when Gaddafi left out of there, it was Turkey who was going down there supplying arms, and through them and the Sudan. And so from there, you've got people picking away a little bit at Egypt, too. And they're backing a lot of this. And so I know when we talked the other day, I think in our past backgrounds, there was a lot of thought that the anti-Messiah came out of Europe. I think this is a Middle Eastern thing. I think Daniel tells us that. I think I recommended some books there if you're interested in the anti-Messiah. They were some good resources. But I think it's just something that, with everything else going on in the world, this is not on anybody's radar, really, in the news or anyplace else. But he's, you know, Erdogan has been working quietly behind the scenes. Of course, he's been dealing with things in Syria and with the Kurds and different other things as well. But I think that area is something to keep an eye on.
His comment about the current leader of Turkey is that he seems to keep a low profile, but seems to be very effective and intelligent in how he gets things done. And it seems that the U.S. has been tolerating him more than they probably should.
And to imagine we have nuclear weapons in Turkey, how quickly could those be taken? Yeah, I don't know. But, and I'm not saying he's the anti-Messiah. I'm saying that's an area for us to be watching, I think. Because I think if the type with Antiochus Epiphanes was that he came out of that area, and even to give you another type, when the Roman armies came to Jerusalem in 70 AD, the 10th Legion was one of them. Prominent legions that was there, and those guys were all located out of that same area, Turkey, Syria. So I don't know the types. I think, as Daniel said the other day, we got to watch the picture, the big picture. Does it fit? Yeah, something to watch for anyways.
I'm going to say that if you're comfortable with those conversations, anyways, in our neck of the woods, it's not that nobody's talking about it. Everybody's talking about stuff like this.
Yeah.
They may not know the answers. We may not have the way to. But if you're willing to have those conversations, it is not a far-fetched thing. People are reading their Bibles. They're trying to figure stuff out.
Right.
You know, they're asking those questions. And if you're somebody that's willing to even just talk about it, you will hear about it in our world anyway up there.
One, I hope you understood where I was coming with Paul's teaching to the Thessalonians. Here's like new believers, and he's way deep into the book of Daniel talking about this stuff. And I think for us, sometimes we think, well, new believers, This is not what they need. He had 3 weeks with them, and he was well deep into it. Just something to consider. Any other thoughts or questions or comments or heckling?
So where's that physical place of safety?
I don't know that there is one. I mean, everybody always talked about Petra, okay? I remember, I almost think it was Dean Blackwell, I heard a message, and he said, I've been to Petra, you better hope it's not Petra, it's a place of safety. Well, I've been to Petra, I understand why he said that. But, I don't know, we read today where his people are taken on wings to a place to be nourished for 3.5 years. Where is that? I don't know. Would seem, in line with some of the other things, it might be in that area of Ammon, Moab, and Jordan, and Edom, because it seems as though that area is protected from the Antimacide. That when he comes swooping down into Israel and into Egypt, those three areas, those three nations, are not apparently affected by him. Don't know. Just a guess. Anybody else? Comments? Yeah, Zach.
Okay, so in Revelation 17, it's talking about the great mystery, the mystery Babylon and all that. And it goes on and it kind of talks about the son of perdition in a way. So it says, this is 17:8, and it says, the beast thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And that they that dwell on the earth shall wonder whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they beheld the beast that was and is not and yet is. And here in is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and he and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. So it doesn't use that perdition a lot in the Bible, specifically talking about this character, and to kind of back it up there. So from my personal research and my life, a lot of the mystery religions all worship this same deity, like they have different names from them and stuff like that.
Yep.
So I personally have gone down the journey where I see that this character, Nimrod, Gilgamesh, Osiris, he has many different names, and I think those names are derived from the 70 different tribes when they're split up at the Tower of Babel. And so right there again, when it says he is coming out of the beast thou sawest was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. So just to kind of back that up a little bit more, just for my own research, is when we talk about Revelation 9 and it says who the king of the lotus are, his name in Hebrew is Abaddon and in Greek Apollyon. Those are also two names that you can directly translate back to Nimrod himself, this character. So yeah. Just some thoughts there. And he was Assyrian. He was he tried to build that tower, the Babel, to ascend up into the heavens to put his throne at the height of the Most Highs. So I think he personally for me is this character, and so would it make that of what you will. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. Okay, anybody else? Let the heckling begin. All right, if not, we'll close. Thanks, everyone.